This meeting of the House Judiciary will now come to order. The time is now 1 p.m. on Friday, February 13th, 2026. We are meeting in the Grunberg Room, Capitol Room 120. Members present are Representative Costello, Representative Mina, Representative Eichscheid, Vice Chair Kopp, and myself, Representative Gray, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Before we begin, I would ask everyone to silence their cell phones. I would also like to recommend the staff supporting this meeting. We have Sophia Tinney from House Records, Kyla Tupo from the Juno LIO, and my committee aide, Dylan Hitchcock Lopez. We have two items of business on today's agenda: HB 239, criminally negligent homicide, failure to assist, and HB 64, surrender of infants, infant safety device. As a reminder, I have rescheduled House Bill 213, Data Sharing Social Security, to Monday so that we can have a representative from DMV available to answer questions in advance of the amendment deadline. We will now move to our first item of business, which is House Bill 239, Criminally Negligent Homicide Failure to Assist, up for its first meeting in our committee. This time, I would like to invite the sponsor, Representative Kopp, and his staff, Gary Zepp, to the witness table. Please put yourself on record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Kopp, House District 10 representative, and I am ably assisted by my team member, Mr. Gary Zepp.
For the record, Gary Zepp, staff to Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This piece of legislation is a public safety and accountability measure that addresses one of the most disturbing crimes that we see on Alaska's roads. That is fatal hit-and-run cases where a life is taken and the driver flees the scene instead of stopping and helping, which the law currently requires. Across Anchorage alone, we have seen dozens of hit-and-run fatalities in this past decade. In fact, about a quarter of all pedestrian deaths involve a driver who leaves the scene rather than stopping and rendering aid. Those are not just statistics, as we know. Some of us are familiar with people who have passed away. These are our sons and daughters, parents, loved ones, neighbors, whose final moments weren't marked just by tragedy, but also by abandonment. So under current law, when a driver's criminal negligence causes a death, that offense is typically a Class B felony. Even when the driver leaves the victim behind, sentences can be constrained by low presumptive ranges. For instance, the Class B felony now is 1 to 3 years for a first offense. Sentences are also constrained by plea negotiations and concurrent sentencing. So if there's multiple incidents out of the same act, they're just sentenced together as one crime rather than as separate offenses. In some cases, offenders have served only a matter of months for conduct that resulted in the taking of a life and a decision to flee the scene and leave the person in the roadway. That outcome, we believe, does not reflect the gravity of the conduct, and it does not match our community expectations for accountability. This legislation, House Bill 239, addresses that gap in a pretty straightforward way, we believe, Mr. Chairman. It creates a higher level of offense, an aggravated form of criminally negligent homicide, when a person causes a death with a motor vehicle and knowingly fails to stop and render aid. So under the bill, the conduct would be elevated from a Class B to a Class A felony with a presumptive sentencing range of 7 to 11 years for a first-time offender. The bill also requires consecutive time when both the homicide and the failure to stop and render aid offenses are present, ensuring the sentence reflects both the loss of life and the decision to abandon the person where they were struck. This proposal does not create any new criminal conduct. I want to be clear. The law already requires that we do these things. But what it does do is it recognizes that when a driver's criminal negligence takes a life and they choose to flee rather than stop and help, that decision compounds the harm. There's no chance for 911, ambulance, EMS, and fire to arrive and give that person a chance at survival. Therefore, it compounds the harm. We believe this legislation aligns the penalty with the seriousness of the offense, and it stays within the constitutional sentencing framework and restores public confidence that these cases are treated with the gravity they deserve. So just before I hand it over to my able team member, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say this legislation is about accountability, deterrence, and basic human responsibility. When someone is dying in the road, the law should demand that the driver stop and help and impose meaningful consequences when they do not. And I would like to now ask Mr. Zepp if he could walk us through this legislation, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Zepp. Please walk us through the section.
Good afternoon, Chair Gray, Vice Chair, COP, and committee members. For the record, my name is Gary Zepp, staff to Representative COP. Before you today is HB 239, which we believe addresses a gap between the current presumptive criminal sentence ranges and consideration of the victim's family's rights of accountability and expectation of justice for losing a loved one. The issue is that fatal pedestrian hit-and-run crashes are occurring all too often, leaving behind devastated families and friends who have suffered the loss of a loved one in a brutal fashion. Why introduce the bill? Plea constraints, low presumptive sentence ranges, and concurrent sentencing for the separate Class B felony crimes of criminally negligent homicide and failure to render aid pull sentences down, even when a driver flees and or conceals evidence. Because of this, we believe the concurrent presumptive sentence ranges need to be elevated. And what does HB 239 do? It creates and combines a new category of aggravated criminally negligence homicide when a death is caused by criminal negligence with a motor vehicle and failure to render aid. It elevates the offense, as Vice Chair Kopp said, from a Class B felony to a Class A felony and sets a presumptive 7 to 11 presumptive sentence range for first-time offenders. It requires consecutive time when both the death and the failure to aid are convicted in the same act, and it keeps Alaska within constitutional sentencing principles while aligning penalties with community expectations. Currently, a Class B felony has a presumptive sentence range of 1 to 3 years for first-time offenders, and these are two separate offenses, currently, criminally negligent homicide and failure to render aid. And for the record, nothing in HB 239 changes the current law if you stop and render assistance. Thank you. Far too often we read where the sentence, while within today's presumptive prison sentence ranges, does not reflect the gravity of causing a death and abandoning the victim, leaving behind families and friends feeling profound grief, rage, and long-term trauma. HB 239 seeks to close that gap by increasing criminal presumptive sentence penalties. The case of Chase Bowerson illustrates why we believe the presumptive sentence ranges need to be increased. The sentence was light because of the charge that the perpetrator pled to, and Alaska's presumptive sentencing rules pulled down the actual time served. And you'll hear testimony from Chase's mom shortly. This chart shows the number of pedestrians killed in crashes over the last 10 years in the Anchorage area. And the data from the research tells us that 25% of these deaths fall into the fatal pedestrian hit and run category. So over the 10 years in Anchorage, that's 221 deaths. 25% of that are 55 deaths. That's 6 annually. The national statistics project a total of 7,148 pedestrians will die as a result of being hit by a vehicle in 2024. And again, the data tells you 25% of those are related to a fatal pedestrian hit and run category. So that means 1,787 pedestrians are expected to die as a result of a vehicle striking them, someone fleeing, and leaving them to die. And what does HB 239 do? It creates a new category of aggravated criminally negligent homicide when a death is caused by criminal negligence with a motor vehicle and failure to render aid. It elevates the offense from a Class B felony to a Class A felony, and again, sets a presumptive sentencing range to 7 to 11 years for first-time offenders. And it requires consecutive time when both the death and the failure to aid are convicted in the same act. And this keeps Alaska within constitutional sentencing principles, again, while aligning penalties with community expectations. And this slide shows a comparison between the current law and HB 239, if enacted. Again, I'm not going to repeat the same thing, but this does increase the current law from a Class B to a Class A felony. And as you can see on the chart here, the difference is between the two. Why now? Courts and prosecutors have repeatedly confronted fatal pedestrian hit-and-run crashes where plea constraints, low presumptive sentence ranges, and concurrent sentencing for a Class B criminally negligent homicide pulls down the sentence, even when the driver flees and/or conceals evidence. This results in a perceived mismatch of culpability and consequence, eroding public trust. And again, for clarification, the current Class B felonies in cases like this are two separate crimes: criminally negligent homicide and failure to render aid. And as noted in this slide, and as a reminder, if you're in a crash and hit a pedestrian, a cyclist, a skateboarder, etc., stop. Call 911 immediately and stay with the injured party until help arrives. You could save someone's life, and it's the right thing to do. I'd like to thank Chair Grave, Vice Chair Kopp, and committee members for the opportunity to present to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. An earlier slide showed the headlines. All of them were very recent daily news headlines showing drivers being sentenced 3 to 4 months for not only criminally negligent homicide, killing someone with a vehicle, but they also fled the scene. And the only reason they were ever charged is the police had to come find them. Maybe the license plate fell off their vehicle or there was a witness. But just only doing months to serve. And the bill really, in addition to bringing in a stronger sense of the value of human life that we believe our community holds for all persons, that we would emphasize the duty to help and stay when those things happen. The bill recognizes, again, that this can happen to any of us as far as accidentally hitting someone. That's not what the bill is focused on. It's for when that happens and then you fail to stop and call 911 and get help coming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Did you want to walk us through the sectional?
Sure. Yes, sir. For the record, again, Gary Zepp, staff to Representative Kopp. The sectional analysis for HB 39 version N, section 1 describes the purpose of the act and creates an aggravated form of criminally negligent homicide, increases the presumptive ranges for such crimes, and requires certain consecutive sentencing to protect public safety better and deter flight from accident scenes. Section 2, which amends 1141.130, which is criminally negligent homicide in Alaska statutes. And this is a person who commits aggravated criminally negligent homicide if the person operating a motor vehicle causes the death of another by criminal negligence and the person knowingly fails to stop and render reasonable assistance as required under statute. And there's also an aggravated criminally negligent homicide under Section C of 2835060, and that is a Class A felony. Section 3 amends 2835060, which is duty to give information and render aid. If a violation of this section occurs in connection with conduct constituting criminally negligent homicide under Section 2, the offense is a Class A felony and must be sentenced under 1255.125, which is the section for sentences of imprisonment for felonies. Section 4, which amends 1255-125. And again, it's the sentences of imprisonment for felony section and statutes. And for a first felony conviction of aggravated criminally negligent homicide under this section or failure to render aid under 2835-060, the presumptive sentencing range is 7 to 11 years. And Section 5 is the mandatory consecutive sentencing. This adds a new section to 1255-025. And this is when a defendant is convicted of both aggravated criminally negligent homicide and failure to render aid for conduct arising out of the same incident. The court shall impose the sentence for the failure to render aid consecutively to the sentence for aggravated criminally negligent homicide, and the composite active term may not be less than 10 years. And Section 6, the effective date is July 1st, 2026.
Thank you. Would you like questions now?
Yes, yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And I will say that we have Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, online to answer questions, as well as Zach Hartman, Traffic Signals Manager, Traffic Engineering Department, Municipality of Anchorage, also to answer questions.
I invite a testimony.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. I'm curious, this question is probably for Nancy Mead, and thank you for being online. Are there other areas of statute where an aggravating factor is served consecutively rather than at the same time?
Thank you, Representative Costello. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. There are the aggravating factors are actually, you know, a separate section of statute that, if proven, can allow a person to be sentenced above the presumptive range that's set in the statutes. This is kind of more accurately described as a more severe type of criminally negligent homicide rather than an aggravated type, because you don't have to prove an aggravating factor. But your question was, are there other crimes basically that require consecutive sentencing? The one I can think of immediately is for violating conditions of release, so that if somebody is convicted of say assault, and in the same case they had a charge for violating their bail conditions, the legislature recently said that they have to get some additional time to be served consecutively. I'm pretty certain about that, but it is not unique, at least, to have consecutive sentencing required, even though concurrent sentencing is more commonly ordered.
Thank you.
I'll just add for the record that we have been joined by Captain Scott Bartlett, Captain of the Alaska State Troopers Department of Public Safety, who is also available to answer any questions. Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, to whoever has the best answer to this. I would like to learn more about the definition of rendering reasonable aid. You know, I've looked at statute. I just was wondering if I could get a further clarification of that, and then I'll probably have a follow-up about a hypothetical to, you know, see how that standard is applied, please.
Sure. So through the chair, the law, and I'll just speak from my own experience as a police officer investigating lots of accidents over a few decades. The law currently, the reasonable care standard, is that whatever you did was just reasonable under the situation. And that standard can differ depending on the severity of the weather, the severity of the circumstances you were in. Let's say it's night, it's an icy road, it's very curvy, and you're going down a mountainside road, and it's almost lethal for you to step out of your car. So something reasonable under that circumstance would be just to pull over as soon as you could and call 911. Maybe it wouldn't be reasonable for you to step out in the road and immediately be in other harm's way of traffic and fall down. So it's all a reasonableness based on what could you do safely under the circumstances to stop and render aid, get help coming. If it's a sunny day, you're on a wide highway with nobody else around, obviously the standard is higher that you're able to pull over safely, run back, check on the person. But it just has to be reasonable in context with whatever you're facing. Alaska recognizes a Good Samaritan exception for civil liability. In other words, it's very difficult to sue someone who's stopping to check on you if they didn't do something quite right when they checked on you. So you're covered under a general immunity shield. Just the act of checking on someone, asking if they're okay, getting 911 on the phone and getting help coming is certainly meeting the requirement of this law.
Follow up. So I, especially the very last part of that, Representative Kopp, made sense to me. So let me give you a hypothetical, because as I understand it, it is to render aid of some sort. It seems like it's to like call 911, obviously wait around. But say that the negligent driver of a vehicle is a certified paramedic. Mm-hmm. They strike somebody, they stop. They call 911, they stick around, but they have additional training but to render additional aid, but they do not. Would that be considered rendering reasonable aid in that scenario where a person is a trained medical provider, could be a physician? So I'm just kind of curious about that hypothetical because people need to know the bar so they don't get on the wrong side of the law.
Yeah. So through the chair, Representative Ayashide, the bar is intentionally set for the common law standard of due care. So it's a lower standard rather than applied to technical capacity of a person. So the message and what's of this legislation and what the law already requires is the duty to stop and render aid. And the law intentionally leaves that broad just because of the very situation that you brought. It, not only can it vary under the circumstances, but the capacity of the individuals involved. And it's a good faith showing is required that you did the best you could under the circumstances to stop, to help the person, and to stay until help could arrive.
Thank you.
I would also like to acknowledge that Senior Assistant Attorney General Casey Schroeder from the Department of Law is here. Can I call you up?
For the record, Senior Assistant Attorney General Casey Schroeder, for the criminal division at the Alaska Department of Law.
Thank you. Ms. Schroeder, can you just, for the record, state that the answers we heard were consistent from your perspective?
Mr. Chairman, as far as the last hypothetical about what qualifies as reasonable assistance, there is actually a jury instruction on what reasonable assistance means. And if I might read that jury instruction to the committee here, it says reasonable assistance means the assistance that a reasonably prudent person would provide under the circumstances. Reasonable assistance may include making arrangements for medical treatment if it is apparent that treatment is necessary. So it's a reasonable person standard.
Thank you. Are there any other circumstances where a crime associated with a mental state of criminal negligence is categorized as a Class A felony?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to think about that. In the homicide context, the Class A felony is manslaughter, as you know, and that mental state is reckless. I'd have to think about whether or not there was anything else that might have been elevated to a felony.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, first, Representative Kopp, I want to thank you for having a desire to figure out what we can do to help protect pedestrians in our state. The hit and runs that we've seen in Anchorage, it's been a huge issue, and it's horrifying to just see vulnerable people on our streets not being helped in these situations. So whatever we can do to help make sure that we are supporting pedestrians, I think it's a good step in the right direction. I have just a few questions just related to the bill itself. So my understanding is right now, someone who does commit a hit and run and they get charged with criminally negligent homicide, failure to render assistance. And I'm looking at the slideshow on slide 7. So status quo, first offense, 1 to 3 years, on criminally negligent homicide, failure to render assistance, first offense, 0 to 10 years. So right now, it looks like I'm trying to understand the minimum and maximum sentences in the status quo versus the bill. And so my understanding is a minimum sentence that someone would get, and since these sentences may run consecutively, so a potential minimum sentence would be 0 years or 1 year. Is it 0 to 20 because it may run consecutively? Could you clarify what is the minimum and maximum for these sentences in the status quo?
Yes, through the chairs, Representative Mina. Thank you. That was a very good question. So in the offense category that this legislation covers, there's two separate Class B felony crimes that are occurring in the incidents we're talking about. One, the act of criminally negligent homicide, where with criminally negligence, you kill someone with your vehicle. And the second is when you failure to stop and render aid. Both of those are currently Class B felonies for first-time offenders. And the presumptive sentencing range for each of those offenses is 1 to 3 years. I'm sorry, on the criminally negligent homicide is 1 to 3 years if you're a first-time offender. For the act of fleeing, leaving the scene, it is 0 to 10 years. So that's a different presumptive range. What we're seeing is that the offenses, even convicted separately for the same act, are sentenced concurrently at the same time rather than consecutively like a train, where you have your sentence for that crime and then you're sentenced for this crime. Because of that, if you're a first-time offender, it's almost as if the separate crime of fleeing the scene and not rendering aid didn't exist for sentencing purposes. You're just sentenced for the first being a first-time offender, criminally negligent, vehicular homicide. And because the range is 1 to 3 years and you're a first-time offender, generally the courts are giving in the 2-year range, somewhere in the middle there. And then when you get a third off for good time, and you can come up for your first parole hearing pretty early, that's why we're seeing the actual time served being just months in jail for this conduct. So the bill is elevating that 1 to 3 to a higher 7 to 11 range, just for the purpose, recognizing that it's still going to be lower than that because people will still be sentenced to the lower end of the range. You're still going to get a third off for good time. And the judiciary system still has the discretion on both aggravators and mitigators in that range to affect what that final sentence would be. So I hope through the chair, Representative Mina, that kind of answered your question a little bit.
Thank you. I will just ask if Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder would agree with the answer.
Through the chair, through Representative Mina, I think that for the criminally negligent homicide under current law, it is a Class B felony, as Representative Kopp has said, and the presumptive range is 1 to 3. So absent any mitigators or aggravators, the lowest sentence the person can get is a 1 year for that offense. The leaving the scene is a 0 to 10. We may be able to argue analogy for presumptive ranges, but it would be 0 that the person could get for leaving the scene. I would suggest, though, that that is not often what happens. Usually there is a sentence imposed for each offense.
Follow up. Through the chair, thank you. Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder, could you talk a bit more about what those mitigating and aggravating factors, what are added onto those sentences and how that affects the duration of the sentence?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, first I'll say that the presumptive ranges are the range, the sentencing range that should be applied for a typical offense within that offense category. And in issuing a sentence within that range, the court will take into account the totality of the circumstances of that case. So, the behavior of the person after the incident, whether or not they got treatment, if they have any criminal history, anything else that may inform the judge about what sentence should be applied within that presumptive range. There is a statute that lists out aggravating circumstances and mitigating circumstances. That's 1255-155. And that is there are more than 20 aggravators and I think more than 20 mitigators. So there is a gamut of types of things that may apply in each case. And whether or not the sentence is aggravated or mitigated, if the state is to prove mitigators, and then conversely, if the defense proves, if the state proves aggravators and the defense proves the mitigators, it's a may. So the court may adjust the sentence and may factor in those aggravators and mitigators to determine what sort of sentence they're going to craft outside of the presumptive range, either lower or higher.
Can I follow up on that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, if the court has the ability to adjust that sentence, I'm trying to just figure out what's the duration of that sentence. If right now in the status quo, it could range from someone serving 1 year and then they might get good time. Or if you're having these two sentences run concurrently or consecutively, it can stretch out to, it seems like 20 years if we're adding the max of 10 years from criminally negligent homicide on top of the failure to render assistance. So what's that ability for the court to stretch or shrink that sentence?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, they have the ability to run those sentences consecutively or concurrently or partially consecutively and partially concurrently. So they have the judge has a lot of leeway in the sentence that they're crafting. But again, they are going to take the totality of the circumstances of the case into consideration.
Follow up. Through the chair, I might not be asking this the best way. Do they add on more? Or let me ask a different question then. Through the chair, so then looking at HB 239, if somebody commits that same crime of a hit and run for a first offense, if it must run consecutively, adding the 7 years from criminally negligent homicide and then the failure to render assistance, which is 10 years, is the first offense, it must be 17 years as a minimum?
If a sentence is to run consecutively, it depends on the nature of those sentences. So if you have a first offense, 7 to 11 years, like say they get 7, first-time offender, and then the second offense is a 0 to 10, and they would get maybe a year, that would be an 8-year sentence. And that 8 years by no means is how long they'll do it in jail on a first-time offense. It's going to be considerably less than that, unless they don't get any good time and things don't go well for them. And in prison, it'll be a significantly reduced. But the whole consecutive aspect to, just to kind of orient the committee to why this is important, is that second crime often involves multiple fatalities in the same vehicle. And every life is extraordinarily precious to whichever was lost. And you can have a single person commit the crime of vehicular homicide, but if they hit a vehicle and kill 3 people and leave all of them, is that just fleeing the scene once? Right? I mean, that's what the court looks at, and that's what Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder's getting at, and the considerations of the court too, and where they come down on the sentencing. You could end up with multiple charges of criminally negligent homicide and multiple charges of fleeing the scene, looking at every person in that vehicle as a victim of nobody stopping to check on them and making sure they were okay. So I look at this bill as simply giving the court more tools in the box to adequately reflect the sense of community justice for these types of situations when loss of life occurs. Yes, it does range, and intentionally so, the minimum, because of what we're seeing now, just several months sentences four people who are struck and killed and the driver stops. Does that help a little bit?
It does. May I do one more follow-up? And then thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. So through the chair, so then my understanding is it does raise the minimum for, let's say it's an instance of a first offense for somebody committing a hit and run, and it's a criminally negligent homicide. So it raises that first offense to a minimum of a sentencing of 17 years. I'm just trying to compare this to other crimes that we have, and I don't know, this might be a question for Ms. Schroedert. For how does that sentencing compare to manslaughter and just other crimes? Is 17 years a lot? I'm just trying to compare it.
Through the chair to represent Mina, I don't think you'll find anyone that says that 17 years is insignificant. Mm. The amount of sentence that's associated with classification of offense is really a policy call. So it is what the legislature wants to set it at. So you asked about manslaughter. Manslaughter is an A felony, and currently the presumptive sentencing range for that offense would be for a first offense would be 4 to 7. And then, you know, if you want to go level up from manslaughter, you're looking at second degree murder and first degree murder. And of course, those sentences are going to carry much longer time, and the conduct is much different. I mean, as I think we all know, murder in the first degree is an intentional killing, as opposed to what we're talking about here, which is criminally negligent and somebody dies.
Thank you.
I'll follow up on that. In terms of Representative Mina's questions about must be consecutive, is that removing judicial discretion? So it's in some ways the judge has less say in the sentencing process because these sentences must be consecutive if this bill passes.
And Mr. Chairman, the bill does say that the sentence shall run consecutively. Yes. So there is no discretion there as far as the consecutive sentence.
Thank you. Any questions at this moment? Because we are going to open public testimony. We have people ready to testify. Thank you so much, Ms. Schroedert. Seeing no more questions at this moment, we will now take up public testimony. Public testimony on HB 239 is now open. Ms. Trent, if you are available, you can take yourself off mute, put yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you great.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Kelly Trent. I appreciate being able to speak to you about my and my family's experience. On January 2nd, 2021, the unimaginable happened to myself and my family. There are no words to describe what happened, so instead, I will ask that each of you imagine the unthinkable. Think of losing someone you can't imagine losing, a spouse or partner, a parent, a sibling, or what is often considered the most horrific, your child. I lost my youngest son and lost him to being hit by a car and left to die. Losing a child is a pain unlike any other pain. Losing a child to a violent, painful death is an added horror. Imagine losing that person because they were hit by a car and left on the cold street to die, as if their life meant nothing. This is what happened to my son, Chase Bowerson. From the first court date to the last, my husband and I attended them all. The court dates were approximately every 4 to 8 weeks for over 4 years. We never missed one in our quest for justice for our son. To our dismay, the man that killed our son was released on ankle monitor almost immediately after he killed him. He violated conditions of release and spent approximately 6 months in jail to then be released again on ankle monitor. The disappointment we felt in our judicial system began slowly, but quickly became undeniable. Over the course of waiting for justice, we became very aware of the plague of hit and run deaths that were occurring in our community. It was unbelievable how many people were being hit by cars and left to die. We thought surely that Chase's case would set an example of justice and that future cases would follow suit. that justice would come through our courts. That did not happen, though. Chase's case began with the killer being charged with murder one, manslaughter, and felony failure to render aid. Then the DA's office told us they would be dropping the murder one and only going for manslaughter. The day before trial was to start, the DA let us know they were going to offer a plea deal to the defendant of criminally negligent homicide and leaving the scene, with him only receiving a 2.5-year sentence and with good time only having to serve 8 months. Since he had done 6 months already in 2022 for violating conditions, he only had to serve a few weeks in jail after sentencing. I have never felt so disheartened by my home state of Alaska. I was being kicked while down by those I thought were here to help us find justice for Chase. The sentence that Chase's killer received is not justice. It is a sentence that tells our community that human life doesn't mean what it should to the state of Alaska. That is not the Alaska that I want. I want the community to know that if they would experience the unthinkable like we did, there will be justice. House Bill 239 will ensure that. We need to make this change so that other families don't go through what we and far too many other families have gone through. My son Chase was a caring, hardworking young man. He owned his own home in Chugiak and was planning on building a cabin on his land in Homer. He had just turned 26 2 weeks prior to being killed. He was a contributing member of Alaska and gave back to our community. After we lost Chase, we found out so much more about his giving spirit. He made donations to shelters for women and children. He gave shoes he had in his vehicle to the unhoused people on the streets many times. We found out he saved an elder's life a few years before he was killed, allowing this Alaskan elder more years with his family. His loss has had a rippling effect, not only on my family and his friends, but to Alaska and the world as a whole. Like many people, I never imagined I would lose my son, never be able to say goodbye to him. Sorry. I just didn't imagine it. Give me a second. I'm so sorry.
Take your time.
I never thought he'd never say, come bounding up my stairs again and say, open up my door, yelling, hey, mom. House Bill 239 will set a standard that Alaska needs to have in place. People need to know that if they do hit someone with their car, they must stay, call for help, and render aid. If they don't do this, the consequences will outweigh any other option. What is in place now does not ensure that. Human life is not something that a person can choose to throw away because of the selfish choice of fleeing and leaving them to die. Please stand with our family in support of House Bill 239 so that no one in Alaska will experience this gross injustice of a life being ripped away and the consequences not being adequate. Thank you, Senator Kopp, for inviting me to speak and the work you're putting into this bill. And thank you to the House for your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Trent, and we're so sorry for your loss.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
We'll now call on Chief of Anchorage Police Department, Sean Case. Can you please take yourself off mute and begin your testimony?
Chair Gray, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 239, which strengthens Alaska's criminally negligent homicide statute and reinforces the duty for drivers to stop and render aid after a serious collision. My name is Sean Case. I serve as the Chief of Police for the Anchorage Police Department, and I'm here to express support for this legislation. I see firsthand the devastating consequences of traffic collisions caused by negligence and the additional trauma inflicted when drivers flee the scene. I think we just heard that. House Bill 239 addresses a critical gap in our current law by ensuring that those who cause death through criminal negligence and then knowingly fail to stop and render reasonable assistance face appropriately serious consequences. This change recognizes that fleeing the scene is not a mere procedural violation. It is a deliberate act that compounds the harm, denies victims potentially life-saving assistance, and obstructs justice. From a law enforcement perspective, this bill would do three things: deter hit-and-run behavior by establishing stronger penalties for those who abandon their duty to assist, promote accountability by aligning sentencing with the moral and social gravity of leaving a person to die, and it will support victims and families by affirming that Alaska values human life and expects drivers to act responsibly, even in moments of panic and fear. In Anchorage, we have seen too many cases where victims might have survived or could have been treated more humanely if the driver had stopped to call for help or render aid. Each of those cases leaves a lasting mark on our officers, our community, and the families who must live with the loss. HB 239 sends a clear message. Leaving the scene of a fatal crash is not just irresponsible, it is criminally inexcusable. I urge the committee to advance House Bill 239. It is a thoughtful, necessary measure that will help law enforcement, prosecutors, and the courts hold offenders accountable while reinforcing the values of responsibility and compassion that define our state. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much, Chief Case. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 239? Seeing no one and seeing no one else online, public testimony on House Bill 249 is now closed. Are there any other questions for the sponsors or any of the folks available online to answer questions? Again, that's Zach Hartman, Traffic Signals Manager, Traffic Engineering Department, Municipality of Anchorage, Captain Scott Bartlett, Captain Alaska State Troopers, Department of Public Safety, and we still have Nancy Mead, General Counsel online for the court system online, as well as Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder with us in person. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, I'm trying to figure out, I don't know who the most appropriate person is to ask this, but there are so many different tools and policies that we can do to help protect pedestrians, especially when they've been hit, and making sure that we're encouraging people to stay with that person. And that's that vital window to prevent a fatality and to prevent that death. I'm curious, in other states that might have these harsher criminal sentencing, criminal penalties related to a hit and run, has that resulted in less pedestrian fatalities, or just, I'm curious what that impact is?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, we do have a breakdown of how states address this behavior, specifically how fleeing the scene ties into the original act of criminally negligent homicide. Alaska would still be on a fairly conservative end. There are a number of states that treat this much more seriously, up to 20, 30 years of imprisonment for doing what this bill, the behavior that they're addressing. So the what we are seeing nationally is we are well within line, I would say, on the lower end of recognizing that it is the act of leaving someone to die that really is the behavior that is making states, state legislatures take a very dim view. And at the same time, recognizing that anybody can accidentally hit someone, and this bill doesn't criminalize that conduct. You know, just stopping and staying and getting help and that's responsible behavior. Most of the time, there's no criminal liability attached if someone jumps out in the middle of you. Middle of winter, dark clothes, and just that could happen to any of us. It's targeting the act of leaving someone there and not fulfilling the duty of the law. So we know we're on the conservative end, and we'd be happy to send you that chart. We do have a breakdown.
I would love that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to call Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder back too.
For the record, Senior Assistant Attorney General Casey Schroeder for the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law.
Thank you. Ms. Schroeder, I was just curious if you knew if there was any evidence of changes in behavior based on changes in the law like this, in terms of, it seems like the goal is to have more people stop and render aid. The goal of the bill is to increase the number of folks who stop after they've accidentally hit somebody. Is there any evidence to show that changing the law like this would incur, would lead to more people stopping their cars to help?
Mr. Chairman, if there is, that's just not something that the Department of Law has. A deterrent effect is difficult to assess.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Kopp.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just two initiatives in the law that we can point to that had remarkable change in behaviors. We increased penalties for DUI. We used to have no mandatory minimum time. And DUI, just the offense alone, was killing tens of thousands of Americans every year. And we still have an average of about 40,000 traffic-related fatalities a year. But the percentage of those being alcohol-related is dropping significantly as our approach to DUI has increased. Another thing is safety belt use. We used to have very de minimis enforcement for safety belt. And with good public messaging, media increased enforcement, you know, now it's almost universal. People wear safety belts. And so it's a combined messaging of the law to raise the idea of this is part of the civic virtue, civic duty that we require, that ultimately, in addition to increased enforcement, it is the responsibility to message. So you see groups like National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and Alaska Highway Safety Office doing their role. As we've increased penalties, it's been combined with messaging. I think together we have two campaigns, both on DUI and seatbelt, that show that they do affect, improve outcomes.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question to Senior Assistant Attorney General Schroeder, as well as to Zach Hartman and to Captain Scott Bartlett. And that is, if you could just offer your opinion to why the most common reason why folks do not stop after hitting a pedestrian.
Mr. Chairman, this would just be anecdotal based on the cases that we've seen. And I would just note that this is not the bulk of the cases that the Department of Law sees. I think I noted in my fiscal note that over several years, we've seen 13. However, I think that a lot of the time people articulate that they are scared, that they got into an accident or got into a crash and you know, freaked out. but there may be other behaviors then after they freak out and leave that may diminish that sympathy.
Thank you. That makes sense. I'm going to go ahead and refer the same question to Zach Hartman with Traffic Engineering Department in Anchorage.
Yeah, Zach Hartman for the record, Municipality of Anchorage Traffic Engineering. From the roadway engineering perspective, we're exposed mostly to the data and how that relates to the injury outcome of the crash. In partnership with the great folks at APD's traffic unit, we have been diligent about meeting with them at scenes of a lot of these recent pedestrian fatality crashes. And we learn about all the other, you know, myriad of factors that go into these tragedies beyond what, you know, shows up in the data. Again, this is anecdotal, like the speaker before me, but oftentimes when we hear about these individual crashes, we end up learning about other things going on with the drivers, why they chose not to stop at the scene, perhaps other things or impairment that would encourage them not to stop because I'm imagining they might worry that those consequences are greater than leaving the scene. All anecdotal, but it's a pattern that we've started to notice as transportation engineering staff have started working closer with APD's traffic unit.
Before I move on to Captain Bartlett, one more follow-up question for Mr. Hartman. Do you believe that the bill, well, I'm not sure I can ask you that way. What would be the best way for us to reduce pedestrian-related fatalities in Anchorage at this time?
To the chair, it's not a great answer, but I think the only honest answer is that it's a global approach. Federal Highways has been beating the drum of what's called the safe system approach. Basically, it involves everyone. So two of the major pieces of the safe system approach is enforcement and EMS response. And to me, it appears that this bill gives better teeth to both parts of those pieces of the safe system approach.
Thank you. We'll now move to Captain Scott Bartlett. I'll repeat the question. Captain Bartlett, if you could please give your opinion as to why most drivers who have struck a pedestrian leave the scene of the crime.
So the sheriff, for the record, this is Captain Scott Bartlett. You know, I personally haven't had this type of investigation, but anecdotally, just like in hit and runs in general, people, they either panic, you know, the flight or flight response kicks in, and they flee for that. They could fear legal consequences, or they may have substances on board. But I'm not in a position to give you like concrete answer on this. It's just anecdotal from my time as a trooper.
Thank you so much. I think what I'll say is that I'm not sure that the general public knows how much better things would be if they stopped and helped, even if there were substances or alcohol on board. Ms. Schroeder, can you speak to that or the sponsor? Just is it can you tell the public that even if they've been drinking and they struck a pedestrian, it's in their best interest to stop and render aid?
So through the chair, the broader legal principle is even if you do something bad, what did you do to ameliorate it immediately after? And as Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder kind of touched on that, and those always end up being mitigators as you work your way through the legal process. I think that you heard the Chief Sean Case say that it's that time lag of not getting help that is causing the loss of many people, that if they could get help right away, they may have survived and still be with their loved ones today. But because help didn't come, or maybe they were even struck a second or a third time because nobody stopped with their flashers on, indicating there's a body in the road. All these things happen when we don't stop. So to his point, he highlighted, Chief Case highlighted that delay or failure actually prevents the saving of many lives.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Costello.
Thank you. As I'm listening to this conversation, it strikes me that it might be valuable for you as the sponsor of the bill to consider a section in the bill that would add a question related to this issue on the driver's license written exam, so that as we have new drivers on the road, they have an opportunity to learn about this law, because I think it would have it'd be very impactful for both, you know, the new drivers and those folks who have to take that test to know that you know, this is out there and that it's really something that they need to be thinking about before it happens, and that might be an opportunity for them to know about it.
Yes, through the chair, thank you, Representative Costello. So, of course, current law now requires the requirement to stop and render aid after hitting either a pedestrian or another vehicle or a cyclist. So we're not changing the law, and that is in the basic driver's manual. But to your point, we could highlight the severity and how important it is, and that it's an increased penalty. The act of leaving someone is not a risk to be taken. That is, the law now considers it to be an even higher duty than before. So your point is still well taken, and it should be highlighted.
One more question. I'm curious if the sponsor would be amenable to discussions of an amendment to add a safe harbor provision to the bill that if you stop and render aid, you wouldn't be prosecuted for minor drug possession, for example. If there's somebody who's not stopping because there's drugs in the car.
Well, I mean, you got me on the spot now. I mean, my number one concern is that people that were stopping and giving aid, and I would be happy to have that discussion offline, Mr. Chairman. I am. I mean, you know where my
For the record, it's me. This is not a deep thought out thing. This is literally from hearing all the answers of people panicking and fleeing the scene and being afraid that they're going to get in a whole lot of trouble. And that's why they're not stopping. If there was some way that we could reassure folks that if there's something minor going on, the most important thing for you to do is stop and render aid. And if you do so, you're not going to be charged for this other minor crime.
So that sounds like a great senior attorney general question. I would say that anything you do to ameliorate something very bad that happened is generally considered a mitigator. We could probably look at it to see if we could you're talking about codifying it. Mm-hmm. An offense would be charged as a lesser, if at all. But I don't know. I mean, that'd be a discussion we'd have to have with the Department of Law to see if we have anything in the law now that would address situations like this.
It brings up a major question for me, though, about the bill itself. I think what we're doing in the bill is putting these two things together, criminally negligent homicide coupled with fleeing the scene. But if you don't flee the scene, there's still this criminally negligent homicide there. But we're also saying if you stop and render aid and do your best, you know, obviously, you know, you're going above the speed limit and somebody steps out in front of you on a dark winter night. This can happen. What I've heard is that in that case, the person completely sober, you know, there's lots of reasons why this accident happened. You stopped and rendered aid. There's no crime charged to that person. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's correct.
Yeah, right. We're not. This bill is not pulling in a new set of criminal behavior. Yet.
So in a way, fleeing the scene is what causes both crimes to be charged. No.
Mr. Chairman, if I just might add some clarification here. I know that we've thrown the term accident around. The statute even says involved in an accident. If something is truly an accident, no crime has occurred. We're talking about criminally negligent homicide. So some act had to be criminally negligent. That is not an accident. So they had to have been doing something or have made a decision that resulted in somebody's death. And if they stay at the scene, they won't be charged with leaving the scene of the accident, but they may still be charged with criminally negligent homicide because they acted criminally negligently. This is not an accident, though. Those are two separate things. If it is truly an accident, there will be no criminal charges.
That was thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Assistant Attorney General or Senior Attorney General Casey Schroeder. You know, a great example just to get our minds around this are the two high school age girls from Sand Lake that were walking on the sidewalk at the Abbott Road interchange where it becomes Diamond. They were on the Abbott Road side, and a drunk driver was up on the sidewalk and mowed them both down, killed them both immediately, and fled the scene. That would be, I think we would all agree, it was a criminally negligent homicide. And two girls that were preschool shopping, walking along a sidewalk, everything was responsible on their end. The driver was driving too fast and very drunk and killed them both and fled the scene. This bill would apply to that type of behavior. Clearly not what we would call an accident.
Correct. Yeah. Thank you so much. I think at this time, I'd like to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 239 for Thursday, February 19th at 5 p.m. Right. So you have quite 5 days. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that the amendments are submitted on time. We'll now set House Bill 239 aside and bring it back up at a later date. Thank you so much to the sponsor and staff, Gary Zepp, for presenting today. Thank you to Assistant Attorney General Casey Schroeder. Thank you to our testifiers, to Nancy Mead for General Counsel Court System, Zach Hartman with Traffic in Anchorage, and Captain Scott Bartlett with the Alaska State Troopers. Thank you all for being here today. We will now bring back up House Bill 64. If staff to Representative Frank Tomaszewski wants to come forward. So we're back to House Bill 64, Surrender of Infants, Infant Safety Device. Because the first hearing on this bill was held last year, I would like for staff to Representative Tomaszewski to give us a brief refresher on the bill before we take up questions and return to public testimony. which is still open.
Thank you, Chair Gray, and the rest of the staff here in committee. I appreciate you allowing me to come forward. I apologize. Representative Tomaszewski is in House Finance at this time. Otherwise, he would have been here. For the record, my name is David Goff, staff to Representative Frank Tomaszewski, and I'm going to go with the opening statements here. In 2008, Alaska enacted its Safe Surrender Law to ensure surrendered infants receive immediate care for their safety and provide legal protection for the relinquishing parent, thereby reduced potential infant death due to illegal abandonment. Our current Safe Surrender Law requires a parent to directly relinquish an infant to another individual. Infant safety devices protect both relinquishing parents and infants. Infant safety devices allow a parent to surrender an infant anonymously through a climate-controlled device at a designated facility. Currently, 22 states authorize infant safety devices. House Bill 64 would authorize the use of an infant safety devices as an additional method of infant relinquishment under safe surrender laws. These devices would safely hold an infant with an automatic lock and constant video surveillance while immediately alerting appropriate personnel of the surrender. Infant safety devices would be placed in conspicuous areas with appropriate signage as determined by the Department of Family and Community Services. An infant safety device may be located at a hospital, emergency department, freestanding birth center, office of a private physician, rural health clinic, municipal police department, state trooper post, fire department, or other facilities designated by the DFCS commissioner. The key with all of these is that there's somebody there to immediately respond to that child being surrendered. And it's just adding another level for a parent that is already making a tough decision to relinquish their child, that they may not have to look into the face of somebody else and say, I feel terrible, I'm going to have to give up my child. They place it in one of these devices and they're able to relinquish the child. There are cards and forms within that structure that if they want to leave pertinent information, they can, but they're not obliged to. Just like when they hand over a child to, say, a firefighter or a police officer, they just hand the child off. They don't have to give a name, identify themselves. They just surrender the infant. So with that...
Thank you, Mr. Goff. Do we have any questions from members? Representative Costello.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward and let your sponsor know. So the entities that would be able to have these aren't necessarily manned 24/7. I was curious if you had considered requiring a live cam any place that there is one of these boxes, because you obviously wouldn't want the infant to be left and then the receiving entity is not aware that the infant is there for whatever reason. Have you put some thought into that, or do other states require that?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, the bill as we propose would have a live cam inside of the box to allow the anonymity of the surrendering parent. That would be immediately fed to whatever surveillance company is required. It also has a device that registers as soon as the box is closed. There's an alarm that goes off on the inside that's silent to the outside, allowing personnel to know. And then a third item is the weight of the infant or the infant being placed inside of the device. There's also monitors that break that signal, much like a safety device for a garage door. When it's coming down, that signal is interrupted and the garage door won't come down. This would also automatically signal to people that are monitoring this baby box.
Any other questions? I just will express my concern that I expressed last year, that because we live in a state with such a high rate of sexual assault and rape and child sex abuse, my concern is of a pregnancy that results from that abuse, and then that victim being forced to put their baby in a box by perhaps the perpetrator, and there not being that opportunity for an intervention. And so that's my concern about the anonymous surrender of infants, is that we're taking away this opportunity for some sort of intervention in an abusive situation. And that's my fear and my concern about the bill. And I don't know if you have any comment on that, Mr. Goff.
Well, that through the chair or to the chair, that's already illegal as it is. And I don't know that we can completely stop that, even if it was handed over to a person, somebody on the street, or I should say to a firefighter or police officer or doctor. They could be coerced before they get there and forced to do it, but it's already illegal. And in those cases, I would hope that that person comes in and reports that, if that's truly the case, that they're being forced to do this. And then maybe there would be some intervention at that point. But it is a tough situation.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Goff?
Mr. Goff, appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
And I've been looking at the other states that have done this, and there's been some really good, tremendous recovery of live babies unharmed because of this work. So thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to follow up on Vice Chair Kopp's. I don't know if you know from the other states. I'm wondering if the live babies recovered from the box, if the boxes hadn't existed, if most of those live babies would have been handed off to a human. Because I'm thinking in some cases where they would have given it to the human, but they're like, well, I can just leave it in the box. I'll take this option. So I'm not, I guess, like, can you quantify how many additional babies were recovered because of this new policy?
To the chair. In researching a lot of this, I didn't find anything that gave us numbers of people that would have surrendered to an individual versus the box. But we do know that several people have used it with the opportunity, whether it be at a fire station and they could have walked right to the door and talked to a fireman or a policeman at a police station. And that didn't happen. They placed it in a box.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, at ease. So it says. Record. We will resume public testimony at this time. It has been open since our last meeting. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? And online. We do have Ms. Pamela Samash, president of Right to Life, if you would like to take yourself off of mute and begin your testimony.
Hello, and thank you for taking my testimony today. And thank you for listening to and introducing once again HB 64. And thank you to Representative Frank for producing this bill. My name is Pamela Samash, and I'm from Nenana, Alaska, and I'm the president of Right to Life Interior Alaska, and I really support HB 64 because I know it saves lives, and I just wanted to go over with you what happens when a baby is left outside, which is currently the situation. So what happens is they go through stages 1, 2, 3, and 4, where the baby will currently, right now, as it stands, will begin to shiver, and their body temperature will drop to 89 degrees Fahrenheit. And then at stage 2, they'll become, and at stage 1, they're screaming, because they're dying. And then at stage two, they'll become drowsy and shivering, and they'll start to go unconscious when they go down to 82 degrees. And then at stage three, they will go unconscious, and they'll drop to 68 degrees. And then at that point, they'll have a cardiac arrest, and the baby will perish. The baby has 15 to 20 minutes to go through these stages at minus 20 before they're gone. And so I really support HB 64 because it stops all of that. if a baby is not wanted and the mother is scared, which is the circumstances that Alaska has encountered, I think four times already, the baby won't go through any of those stages. They'll be warm, they'll be responded to, they'll be loved, they'll be cared for, and the mother will have the information she didn't used to have when she left the baby, like on a bench at the park in Anchorage. She'll have all kinds of information to get herself medical care, because there's a good chance that there could be a placenta or something still up inside of her that could kill her 2 days later. So it's good for the mom, and it's good for the baby. So please support HB 64. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Samash, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name.
That's okay.
I am not seeing anyone else online for public testimony. So seeing no one else online or in the building for public testimony on House Bill 64 is now closed. I will also say for the group that we do have Matthew Thomas from Nurse Consultant 2, Division of Healthcare Services, available for any questions that people may have about the bill. Are there any further questions for Mr. Goff or Mr. Thomas at this time? Representative Costello.
Thank you. What happens after the baby is placed in the box? Where does the baby go? Is it with the state? And what happens after that?
Through the chair to Representative Costello, the baby is then transferred to police custody and then goes through child services. There would be an investigation to see if the child is determined to be of Native origin, then the Native Council is also brought in and determined for placement that way. Otherwise, the child is put up for adoption through the foster care system.
Thank you. Other questions?
I do have another question.
Yes, go ahead.
So what about any, currently if you have a baby in the hospital, there's tests that are conducted and various medical, things that occur. I mean, where's the medical treatment? Does that actually happen?
Through the chair to Representative Costello. I'm not sure what all of the procedures would be, but I'm sure that they would be checked out medically. I would imagine they would be taken to a local hospital or care facility to check on their health at that time. I would imagine that they would probably do a blood draw even to see if there's any drugs within their system, depending on the mother's condition at birth, or checking for any medical necessities that are going to happen. Usually an Apgar test is taken at birth. So I don't know that would be relative at that point, but I would presume, but I don't know, be examined at a medical facility as part of their custody.
I have a question, and I know we probably went over it last year and I just don't remember. But we're talking about newborns, but I remember that you could put a baby up to 1 year old in the box.
To the chair. I was just reading this earlier today. In Alaska, it is 21 days.
21 days.
I mean, a larger child would fit in the box, but legally under the safe surrender, it's up to 21 days.
So what would happen if someone put a 22-day-old baby in the box? There's no way to know that. What if someone put a clearly a walking baby in the box, a 10-month-old.
Yeah. Through the chair, I haven't investigated this, but I would have to defer to somebody that would have that legal knowledge. I would imagine that there would probably be more checking to try and find out who the parents are, because they don't meet the criteria even of turning the child over to authorities. Mm-hmm. There may be some investigation to find out what's going on here.
So when we had previous testimony last year, mm-hmm. and one of those people who testified said that they had gone to a baby box in Florida, the report was is there were actually some cameras outside the baby box. And I know that in this case, we're saying that the camera would be inside the baby box. But in the case, if there was a 10-month-old baby in the baby box and they needed to investigate, having that camera outside the baby box would be crucial to the investigation. And I'm just curious, you know, what we would, you know, I don't know. I just feel like there's got to be a way if somebody puts an older child in the box and abandons it to find out who the parent was.
To the chair, we have not proposed that they put a camera up because of the whole anonymity and allowing them to have that. But I would presume that at a police station, a fire station, a hospital, there may be some outside cameras that are doing other work that would lead to investigation as well. And I would also say, most likely, if you ran a DNA test on this child, with everybody doing DNA tests now, there would probably be some link back to the family that could be pursued. That would be a police issue to do that investigation. Our concern is really about saving the life of this child. And even if this child is 10 months old or a year old, and they do place them in the box, we're worried about that child's safety.
Thank you. Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, so this discussion right now, you know, I understand about having the camera in the box to protect the anonymity of the mother placing the infant in the box. However, it just occurs to me most places where these boxes would be, there will be security cameras, fire stations, police stations. This building, they all have security cameras. So how do you guarantee the anonymity of the mother? And moreover, how do you, you know, anybody that realizes we are in a surveillance society can't assume anonymity despite the best intentions. Any comment on that?
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, my statement to that would be that the fact that the whole safe surrender law is about surrendering the child. If they wanted to surrender to an officer or to a firefighter or doctor, there would not be anonymity there either. This is just maybe the possibility of not having to look you in the eye as a mother or a father that is giving up a child and say, I'm turning over my child. There is some sense of anonymity in the fact that they're not having to relinquish that child to a person, and it's still accomplishing that. There's always going to be, like I said before, that child is going to grow up someday, maybe look for their parents. It's probably going to be through DNA that they're going to find their parents. It may be through a camera system, but we can't guarantee their full anonymity, like you said, with cameras everywhere. But there's still that distance with a camera versus facing a person individually. And I think that's the security for them. I don't know. I haven't been in the position of giving up a child. It would have to be a hard decision.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Goff. Does this bill have anything to do with anonymity? Is anonymity ever addressed in it?
Through the chair to Representative Kopp. No, it's not truly anonymity.
Right.
It's surrender of the child.
Thank you. Does this bill have to do with safely abandoning a child and extinguishing your legal duty to support that child?
Through the chair, yes, it does.
Thank you. Does the bill require you to put the baby in an infant safety device that is at a hospital, emergency department, freestanding birth center, office of a private physician, rural health clinics, things like that? Is that what the bill requires you to do?
Through the chair, no.
That's what I'm reading.
It doesn't require you to...
No, if you use an infant safety device, the bill says this is where those will be located.
Those are, or any place that is approved by...
Sure, a commissioner through regulation.
Correct.
Yeah.
But you can still surrender to an officer or to a living person.
Yes, yeah.
Correct.
We're just getting our heads around where these devices will be located. Yeah. So I guess that goes to Representative Costello's question about a close and approximate medical care. And I think the bill clearly says just by nature of where these places are allowed, that medical care will be immediately forthcoming. And I think it's mostly addressing civil liability for a parent deciding to not assume any more responsibility for the child and be able to do that safely without prosecution from the state of Alaska. Am I correct on that?
Through the chair to Representative Kopp. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just mention from the public testimony that we just heard, the concern for retained placenta after birth being a health risk for the mother. Mm-hmm. And, that is also a concern of mine, again, going back to a state with a high rate of abuse, and perhaps we have a 13 or 14-year-old mother being forced to surrender this baby after giving birth at home. I mean, and maybe this is an extreme example. Maybe you have a different example in your mind, but I'm thinking of we're talking about probably lower-income people giving birth in at home without medical care and then being forced to place the baby in the box. I just worry about not having that potential intervention, especially if the mother needs medical care and it's not, you know, the baby box is not going to provide that.
To the chair, that same mother could be going to an individual and dropping that child off to that individual, and they may not have knowledge of a medical condition with them at that moment. And there have been cases where very wealthy families have had children while in school, concealed the pregnancy, concealed the birth, and that child died. The parent could have died as well. This is really about the child and the child's future, and not to be harsh. We would want that mother to go to the hospital.
But the concern is for the baby.
But the concern of this bill is for the child, and then the criminal act of being able to make it non-criminal by the surrender. But I understand where you're coming from for sure.
Thank you. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Through the chair, so in the testimony, with the mention of you know, the mom might also be in a dangerous position after giving birth. So I'm looking at the bill again, and part of the requirements, I'm looking at page 3. Are there any requirements for the infant safety device to have information about resources to, you know, potentially help support the child, that there are resources out there, or medical information or anything to help the mom in this situation?
Through the chair to Representative Mina, there is a whole package that is put in the infant device, the receiving box, that has information on healthcare and also a form that they can fill out if they don't want to be anonymous. They can fill out, my child's name is such and such, born on this day, maybe our family has a history of these medical concerns, but there is a whole package that is put in there so that the mother can look through that and decide what she wants to do as well, which would also direct them to medical care.
Follow up? Through the chair, in the bill, there's no requirement to have that information. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's not spelled out as individual pieces in the box.
Follow-up? Through the chair, I understand Safe Haven is the main company that makes the infant safety devices. Are there any other companies that make these devices?
Through the chair to Representative Mina. In my research, I have not found other companies at this time that are making these devices.
Just a comment. I appreciate that Safe Haven has that information on those devices. I think that's a positive step. I would be interested in seeing if we could potentially require that for these devices to make sure that the mom in the situation knows that there is support out there.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions. Oh, Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Chair Gray. Just through the chair, in your research, have you, from other states, have you encountered any situations, documented situations where somebody, a non-parent placed the child, the infant in the infant box, and it was against the mother's will. Have you run into that at all, sir?
Through the chair to Representative Eichheit, I didn't find anything on a non-parent or that being reported to drop off a child in one of these devices. There was a case that parents had a child that had passed away before they put the child in the device, and that child was found to have had passed before it was put in the device, and that was the only thing that I found that was a negative in that aspect. But no other people dropping off children of other people at that point.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I would now like to set an amendment deadline for House Bill 64 for Thursday, February 19th at 5 p.m. Please work with my committee aide to ensure that amendments are submitted on time. We will now set House Bill 64 aside and bring it back up at a later date. This concludes today's business before the committee. Before we adjourn, here's our preview of our next meetings. Monday, February 16th, consideration of governor's appointees to the Commission on Judicial Conduct, Aldine Kilbourn and Jane Morris. And then we will also take up House Bill 213, data sharing, Social Security. The DMV will be present to ask questions about that bill, which is the one to renew Social Security, replacement Social Security cards online. And then on Wednesday, February 18th, we'll have a presentation on children's justice by the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force, assisted by the Alaska Infant Learning Program Association. And then on Friday, February 20th, we will hear House Bill 136, Railroad Utility Corridors, by Representative Kopp. We will hear House Bill 239, Criminally Negligent Homicide, Failure to Assist, by Representative Kopp. And House Bill 64, Surrender of Infant Safety Device, by Representative Tomaszewski. Thank you to David Goff for presenting for your boss today.
Thank you to the chair and the committee.
And the time is now 2:33 p.m., and this hearing of the House Judiciary Committee is adjourned.